We are surrounded by beauty in our region, one of the many things that make this a great place to live. But pause for a second and think about some of the elements that make up that overall beauty. Trees, you might say. Well, what kinds of trees? Look outside of town in particular and you notice the profusion of conifers, firs and pines and cypresses and more. Today's guest is a big fan of conifers. Last time he was here, he talked about his book, Conifer Country. Now he's written another book called Conifers of the Pacific Slope, a field guide to the conifers of California, Oregon, and Washington. Michael Kaufman is the conifer fan and our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Michael, glad to have you back.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Should point out that Michael lives in Neyland in Humboldt County and works as a teacher. Where are you from originally, Michael? Because you didn't have conifers in quite this profusion around you growing up, I understand.
Right. Yeah, I grew up on the East Coast in Virginia. And actually, there's a decent amount of conifer diversity in the southern Appalachians, but and an extremely high amount of plant diversity, very similar to the Klamath Mountain region where we live. But yeah, you're right. The real conifer hotspot in really North America is right around the Rogue Valley and the Klamath Mountains, and then obviously also including, because of my new book, California, Oregon, and Washington. So the Pacific Slope, as I call it.
Why such diversity here and not in other parts of the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, about half of the world's conifers grow around the Pacific Rim. So between Japan is a real conifer hotspot, China, and then also our region. And the reason goes back millions of years when the land masses used to be more connected. They were sort of sharing this flora. And because of the temperate nature next to the Pacific Ocean, but also the cooler climate that you get as you move a little bit further north away from the tropics, really nurtured this hotspot of diversity between our region and then also Eastern Asia.
Michael, can you remember the first time you came west and saw a giant redwood or a sequoia?
Yeah, that was a real poignant experience in my life. I was 13, and my parents took my brother and I on a trip to San Francisco, and you know, we wanted to see the city, and we did the city stuff for a few days, and then we decided to head north to Muir Woods, and that was the first time I ever saw a redwood tree, and they blew my mind. These things were 300 feet tall plus, absolutely humongous trunks, and we went from there to Yosemite, and you know, I figured we were going to Yosemite to see the big granite and the waterfalls, which we really enjoyed. But we also found ourselves almost an afterthought from the beauty of the granite was stopping at Mariposa Grove, which is where giant sequoias grow, a relative of the redwood, of course. And that's the largest living, those are the largest living things on Earth. So I was presented with these two absolutely spectacular species in this trip when I was 13, and I just sort of built in my memory, and I ended up finding myself, after graduating from college at 21, moving west to teach at an outdoor science school down in Tulare County, which turns out to be the place where most giant sequoia groves in the world are. I think it's well over half of all giant sequoia groves are in this county that I ended up luckily finding a job in after college, and I was able to explore even more. And it wasn't just giant sequoias in Tulare County. There's foxtail pines on the tops of the peaks in Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park, Paiute cypresses in Kern County, just south of Tulare. So I started to see all of these really unusual species, charismatic species. I call them charismatic megaflora. And I started to ask questions, why are they here? Why... of course, I also ended up finding myself exploring mountaintops and wilderness areas and finding more and more of these conifers, but I began to ask questions about it, and it sort of became my weekend passion to explore these things, and soon summers, and here I am, two books later, writing about these cool trees.
Right. They really are cool, and Michael Kaufman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Conifers of the Pacific Slope. Michael, the large trees, I mean, is this an accident of history? I mean, is it possible that we're not going to see them this big again, or is it just that the conditions were right at one time to make them?
Well, yeah, the redwoods and sequoias and their relatives, they used to grow across the northern hemisphere 65, 100 million years ago. And basically how I like to explain that is that the climate in which we live now here in the Klamath Mountains basically mimics what used to be across the northern hemisphere. So there were 7, 8, 9 different species of redwoods and sequoias. And with climate change, so over millions and millions and millions of years, these trees migrated on a very slow scale, finding and pursuing that climate that mimics, it's a temperate climate, often a long growing season. Basically here on the Redwood Coast in Northern California, we have 350, 360 days a year that these trees can grow. So that helps them a lot to get big. We also have good soil. So these conditions, basically the sequoias and the redwoods have retracted, so to speak, into the locations that mimic this climate of 100 million years ago. So the question is, often posed by researchers and scientists or just plant lovers, will these species expand their range again? Will there be the potential for more evolution that's a great question.
All right, much more to talk about with Michael Kaufman. His book is Conifers of the Pacific Slope, a field guide to the conifers of California, Oregon, and Washington. Last time we had him on, there were lots of questions about individual conifer species and where to find them. We may have more of those. Call them in at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or email them to jx@jeffnet.org. Back with your comments and questions for Michael Kaufman on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. Our guest is Michael Kaufman, who lives in Humboldt County and writes about conifers. This is his second book on the subject, Conifers of the Pacific Slope, a field guide to the conifers of California, Oregon, and Washington. With this book in hand, you will be able to identify conifer species you run across when you're out and about, and it is compact enough to be able to carry along on a hike. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your comments or questions about conifers and the places they grow and what kinds we have in our region. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Email address, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the general range of climate in our region. I guess we'll get to the issue of climate change and its effect on that. But the fact is that there has been a lot of climate change already over millions of years, and essentially the diversity of conifers really kind of receded into where we live.
Yeah, I see conifers as harbingers for this climate change, because if we go back to history, let's do a brief history of conifers because I think it's fascinating, or really plants on land. 425 million years ago, plants became compatible with land. They developed this cuticle so they could save water in their leaves. They had spores to reproduce. So things like mosses and liverworts creeped out of the ocean and onto the land. Well, about 350 million years ago, plants began to develop vascular tissue so they could start to grow upwards. And that was a big leap for plants. But the really big leap was the development of the seed, and that's where the gymnosperm, which is the big group of that includes conifers, when that seed came along, it allowed for dormancy so that those conditions didn't need to be perfect for that spore to plant itself in the earth and grow. The seed was protected to a degree, and it allowed for a little bit more time for maybe the rain to come back or the weather to warm just a little bit. And with that jump with the seed, the plant life really took off. And 300 to 200 million years ago, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of species of gymnosperms and conifers in particular. Now we've only got about 1,000 species. So this is a group that was once extremely common. But now, due to shifting in climate, competition from flowering plants, which basically contract with animals for pollination of their flowers. They have really often have one-on-one relationships, mutualistic relationships with animals that promotes evolution at a much faster pace. So we kind of see, I see conifers as this relic, this ancient lineage of plants that is sort of on the downward trajectory of in terms of number of species. Way less than 1% of all plants on Earth are conifers, but yet they still cover 30% of the forested land on the planet. And that really starts to be true north of the California-Oregon border. As you move up into Washington, Canada, the boreal forests of conifers are absolutely extensive across all of Canada and in northern Asia, across Russia. So it's yet, even though these plants are in decline, they, as far as number of species, they are still extremely successful across the landscape. And I think that that's a really cool story because it does tell the story of climate change. And where these trees are today is a reflection often of 100 or 200 million years ago in the evolution that's occurred within those species. So I think it's pretty cool stuff. And of course, if anyone's familiar with my book, Conifer Country, that explored why that diversity still exists in our region, the Klamath Mountains. And that we basically have 5% of the Earth's conifers within a two-hour drive of the Rogue Valley or Humboldt County or, you know, wherever you're heading into the mountains from. 5% on Earth in this one little corner of the world. And what Conifers of the Pacific Slope does is expands that out. And within California, Oregon, and Washington, we have 10% of all conifers on Earth. So amazing diversity right here. And I think it can really it really opens a window into, like I said, evolution, but also just understanding ecology and plant distribution, why things are where they are.
Michael Coffin, the book is called Conifers of the Pacific Slope, but lest people think Pacific Slope is just within sight of the ocean, how do you define it for the purposes of the book?
Yeah, so there was a book that was published in the early 1900s called Forest Trees of the Pacific Slope. It was by George Sudworth, and I guess Pacific Slope used to be a much more common vernacular, mostly with early Western explorers. So as soon as they hit that continental divide and the slope of the water moved towards the Pacific, they used the term Pacific Slope. So this is something that used to cover North and South America. But with Sudworth's book, he focused mostly on Western North America and the plant diversity, tree diversity there. And then even more recently, the Pacific Slope is really come to sort of hug the Pacific Ocean, the landscape there. So I kind of want to celebrate Sudworth's book with my title, but also just begin to explore, use it to define these three states where we really have a lot of plant diversity and symbolically the conifer diversity as well.
So how did you structure the book? I mean, it is pretty handy for having along on hikes, I noticed, but with color coding. What do the color codings lead you to?
Yeah, so we have three families of conifers in the states here, the Pacific Slope, as I call it. One of those groups is Cupressaceae, which includes things like redwoods and cypresses, cedars, junipers. The largest group are Pinaceae. Those are the pines, the firs, the spruce, typically what we bring into our homes in about a month or so for Christmas. These are the trees that we're most familiar with as far as conifers go. And then there's pretty uncommon. There's still only two species in Taxaceae. Many people are familiar with the yew.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also something called a nutmeg that lives only in California. It's not really a nutmeg, but it's got a fruit that looks like a tropical nutmeg. Those are the three families. So I structured it in that way, but I also structured it within those families just based on morphology, so how the seed forms and looks, just to help aid with identification, because there's only, I say only lightly, there's 65 species of conifers here in the Pacific Slope. But they're really not that easy to identify. Botanists struggle. There's some in here that are even debated whether it's one species or two. So it was difficult, based on morphology and based on, which is basically the look of the plant, And based on where the plant grows, I really hoped to define a little bit better what these species are. And I also included range maps, which I think is probably my favorite part of the book. The color pictures that I took across, and I had some help from some other friends who contributed photos, but the color pictures are a nice feature. But what I like about the range maps is it really allows you to see this large scale, these large scale patterns on the landscape. So you can see why, or maybe understand the ecology of a western red cedar that reaches its southern range limit, where I am right now in the Eel River Valley near Fortuna. But as you move north, it begins to expand its range eastward into the Cascades, just north of Medford. You can begin to find western red cedars very far inland, whereas where I am here in California, they extend maybe a mile or two from the ocean. So what that says to me is the climate right here is very similar to the climate at, say, Crater Lake or in the foothills up to Crater Lake. And I think that's an interesting, those are interesting patterns to begin to read through these trees.
Michael Kaufman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Conifers of the Pacific Slope, a field guide to the conifers of California, Oregon, and Washington. You can join this discussion on the Exchange. Ask your questions about different types of conifers you might have run across and where they grow and what they do. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was already writing up a question about islands of these conifers, and then I saw the maps in the book and realized, oh, yes, there really are some concentrations here and some concentrations way over there. And you were just talking about why, because the ecosystems will, well, the climate systems will mimic one another, potentially hundreds of miles and many degrees of latitude apart. But do the trees then grow up somewhat differently? Are there evolutionary differences from island to island within a species?
Yeah, and we see that, again, right here in our region. If you think about historic climate changes in, say, the Pleistocene 2 million years ago, as glaciers pushed southward, they reached their southern terminus in, say, central Oregon, maybe a little further south. And what they would do is they chase those trees into the Klamath. And then as the glaciers receded back north, those trees were able to expand back north. So when we have this mixing going on with the genetics in an area like this, there is some confusion. We had a call last time I was on about the firs in our region. The firs are this hybridization hotspot right here because of this these migrational patterns. Some of these trees move south into the Sierra Nevada, and then the genetics move back in to the Klamath Mountains, and the same is true for firs in the Cascades into the Klamath. So we're at this mixing place for those firs, and that often makes identification difficult. There was a guy that used to live in Ashland, Eugene Parker, who was extremely passionate about understanding the firs of the Siskiyous, and published several papers about it. And he was one of the prominent botanists to really first begin to define these firs based on characteristics and ecology and their distribution. So what I hoped with this book is to begin to synthesize a lot of that information for all these different species. So Parker was passionate about the firs, but it also integrates the spruces and the pines into the equation. So
all kinds of stuff in here. Let's take a call. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Kaufman. His book is Conifers of the Pacific Slope.
Oh, Conifers of the Pacific Slope.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you. I've always wondered about the Monterey pines. And when I lived down near La Jolla in California, San Diego County, there's something called the Torrey pines. And to me, it's kind of a contradiction. They look like big bonsais on the top and the way they lean. And one more thing, I heard the oldest tree I read this years ago was a bristlecone pine. It seemed to be growing out of a rock somewhere in the middle of nowhere. So I'd appreciate comments on that. Why do those trees lean so much in Monterey and La Jolla?
Probably from the wind, but we'll take it from there. Thanks for the call, Jeannie.
Jeannie knows her conifers. I'm impressed. So let's start farther south. The Torrey pine, that's the second rarest pine on the planet. There's only about 5,000 of those trees left. 3,000 are in north of San Diego at the Torrey Pines State Reserve and around the Torrey Pines Golf Course, which many people have heard about. But there's also about 2,000 trees out on Santa Cruz Island in the Channel Islands National Park. So that's a neat story. They're actually quite similar to some of the other coastal pines, like the Monterey pine, in their ecology. But due to, again, climate change and the rising ocean level, those trees were trapped out on that island and also trapped on the, based on moisture level and soil type in the Torrey Pines State Reserve. And then as you move further north, Jeannie talked about the Monterey pine. Basically, there's three native populations of that tree centered around the Monterey Bay Area. There's some a little bit north and some a little bit south. Similar story, climate change, these trees have become restricted to these environments, but those three populations. But the interesting story with the Monterey pine and also the Monterey cypress is that these trees were used by Caltrans and also other highway development organizations, and they were planted all along highways along the coast. And now that the range, we call this ecological release based on where humans have transported these trees, now they're growing, at least the Monterey pine and the cypress to the same degree, all the way north up into Washington, whereas the Monterey pine now in its native habitat is actually being threatened by certain pathogens, of fungus that affects, creates a canker. So it's sort of an interesting story that it's enlisted the help of humans to help expand its range again, and it's really worked out. So if you drive the highways, Highway 1 or 101, you'll see these trees all over the place. And then I'll touch on the bristlecone pine because that's another fascinating story. The bristlecones live basically in the Great Basin and in the Rocky Mountains. There's a Rocky Mountain bristlecone. There's a Great Basin bristlecone. And then we also have in the Klamath Mountains in the southern Sierra Nevada, I mentioned it earlier, the foxtail pine. And all these three species are closely related. They evolved about 40 million years ago, somewhere around maybe where New Mexico, Colorado are today. But now they really prefer the highest of the high mountaintops. And these are the Sky Islands, Jeffrey, that you were referring to. These mountaintops are now restricted through climate change to almost where other plants don't want to be, these inhospitable environments. And the bristlecones do seem to grow out of rocks, as Jeannie said.
And parts of them are dead, aren't they? Usually large parts of them?
Yeah. They can be 4,000 or 5,000 years old, and they slowly die, and they get this strip bark that sort of weaves the vascular tissue up and creates leaves maybe on one side of the plant, or just one little piece of the bark is still alive and the whole tree is alive. So, yeah, it's really real fascinating to see those trees. And why they do so well in these mountaintops is there's few pathogens that can live up there. So there's not a lot of fungus, there's not a lot of insects that are going to come affect these trees. So they've evolved and adapted to conserve water. They often shut down in the summer if it's been a dry year, they'll shut down photosynthesis and just wait it out until the snow comes back. So, yeah, pretty amazing stories, and that's the thing about these conifers is they all have some story like that you can read as you visit them in their native habitat.
Let us take another call. Here's Lamar in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Kaufman. His book is Conifers of the Pacific Slope. Lamar, go ahead.
Oh, thanks. I'm lucky enough to get to spend my summers in the Cascades fishing, and one of my favorite spots is Diamond Lake. And there, I think it's a fir that has a very distinct branch foliage to it that swirls out like a dancer's dress, a square dancer's dress. And I was wondering if you could help me identify that. I think it's a white fir.
All right. Let's see if we can get some more spotting features, Michael.
Yeah, it sounds, if you know it's a fir, it could be a Douglas fir, which is probably the most common conifer in the Pacific Slope. But I've been to Diamond Lake before, and there are white fir up there as well. I like your description of the of the white fur.
The square dancer's dress, yeah.
The square dancer's dress. So, yeah, it probably is a white fur, but, again, the furs are a little bit complicated, and they don't keep their cones long because animals really enjoy eating the seeds. So as soon as the cones are out, they're often being consumed by critters, and the cones are one of the more diagnostic traits for identifying them because they sit upright on the tree. So if you can catch that cone in early summer, you'll know it's a fir.
And so what makes the difference between a fir and a pine?
Yeah, it's basically the cone. It's also the needles. Pines are often, the needles are often bunched together with a fascicle, so they're in bundles of 2, 3, 5. There's a couple of pines that have only one needle, but they're mostly in the southwest in the desert, the pinyon pines. Firs have these upright cones. The way the needle attaches to the branch is a diagnostic feature. And these are all things that I help define and explain in Conifers of the Pacific Slope.
It is rich with pictures as well as words. We have much more to talk about with Michael Kaufman. His book is Conifers of the Pacific Slope, a field guide to the conifers of California, Oregon, and Washington. We'll take a break and come back and talk more with Michael, and we'll take your phone calls and emails when we return as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. This is today's final segment. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Michael Kaufman, a resident of Humboldt County, about his latest book on conifers. His first book was called Conifer Country. This one is called Conifers of the Pacific Slope, a field guide to the conifers of California, Oregon, and Washington. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the trees and how to tell them apart and why we have such a diversity of them here in our region. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to bristlecones for two reasons. Number one, there was a story that another guest relayed to us a while ago about science 1964 style, in which people didn't know how old a bristlecone pine was, and so they cut it down so they could count the rings and probably killed the oldest thing on Earth in the process. But I do notice that in this book, Michael, you have bristlecone firs. And how are they different from the bristlecone pines, and are they very much younger than the bristlecone pines?
Yeah, good question. The bristlecone firs has a similar story to both the Brewer's spruce, which is endemic to the Klamath Mountains, in that it had a much broader range. We call this a paleo-endemic, so an ancient endemic now. The bristlecone fir only grows in the Santa Lucia Mountains down near Monterey. The Monterey area is like another conifer hotspot besides the Klamath. It's kind of got maybe a drier environment, so it's enticed more xeric-loving or drier-loving conifers to persist there, but also with that proximity to the ocean. So the bristlecone fir is not in any way related to the bristlecone pine, but the cone on the fir has these extremely long bracts that extend up to 2 or 3 inches out from the cone, and it's a really beautiful cone and has drawn the attention of naturalists for many, many years. So, yeah, they're basically in our region, in California, you can see all 7 western firs because the bristlecone only grows in California.
The web of life that exists in forests, I mean, much has been said about ecosystems and the way that species can be so interdependent on one another. Like, for example, the way that the willows grew back in Yellowstone when they reintroduced wolves because they were preying upon the elk that had been able to browse with no interruption on the willows for years. So what sorts of other critters need to be around conifers to make them possible?
Yeah, that's another great question. The conifers, it's interesting, they're exclusively wind-pollinated, so they do not rely on animals whatsoever for their reproduction events.
As you pointed out before, some plants have really outsourced their, contracted out, as you put it, their pollination.
So in some ways, conifers are limited by that. Like if they're left on a mountaintop after millions of years of climate change, they can't get their genetics out and adaptively radiate as easily. But what they do still do is enlist mammals and birds for seed distribution. So, for instance, I talked about the group Cupressaceae, which includes redwoods and cypress. It also includes junipers. Most Cupressaceae, besides the junipers, are in these very restricted environments like redwoods, hugging the coast, or giant sequoias in the Sierra Nevada. But junipers are actually circumboreal in the temperate regions of the world, so between the tropics and or the subtropics and the far northeast, the boreal regions. And they, the reason that they have been become so successful across the center area of the northern hemisphere is because they have a berry-like cone that entices birds to help distribute them. The same is true for whitebark pine, and the whitebark pine is one of these trees that lives on mountaintops now. It prefers these cold winters and dry environments that are often quite sunny. They have this keystone mutualistic relationship with a bird called the Clark's Nutcracker. I actually got to study these trees with the Forest Service in California this summer because Canada just listed it as an endangered species. They're dying off rapidly in the northern Rockies around Yellowstone because of climate change and other issues, introduced pathogens. But the cool thing with this Clark's Nutcracker is they basically cache the whitebark pine seeds, and they'll cache like 20,000 of these seeds in caches of, say, 50 seeds. So they scarf up a bunch of them, put them in their mouth, and they bury them. And the spatial memory of this bird is second to none. They remember where 75-80% of these seeds are, but that quarter of the seeds they forget, we're talking upwards of 5,000 seeds. They forget about them. That's, of course, the anthropocentric term. Who knows if they forget or they? It's just too much for the winter. But anyway, we like to say they forget about them, and then they sprout up. So if you go to Crater Lake, you see these clusters of whitebark pine that 200-300 years ago was a Clark's Nutcracker cache. So you can see that relationship, 400-year-old relationship, in the growth form of these whitebark pines, which I think is a pretty darn cool,
that is pretty cool
thing to pursue.
We have about 10 minutes left and about six questions here for you, starting with an email from Bruce in Happy Camp. How would you like to see things change in forest management in terms of harvesting practices and firefighting evolve for long-term ecology?
Well, if we just stay focused on the whitebark pine, in my explorations on mountaintops in Northern California this summer, I saw a lot of fir encroachment in whitebark pine territory, and that's because of fire suppression. So we do need to begin to look at that management in the future. Maybe reintroducing fire or taking out the firs manually so that these trees have a little bit of assistance, because with climate change, firs begin to move in up slope into the whitebark pine, historic whitebark pine habitat.
Let us take a call from Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Kaufman. Conifers of the Pacific Slope is his book. Michael in Mendocino. Oh, I'm sorry, I got the wrong. Let's see, let's do this right. Let's push the right button. There's Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Mr. Kaufman. I'm standing on my back deck looking at the goodly number of redwood trees I have. Now, I've been observing redwoods for about 50 years. I remember climbing them when I was a kid. It's just in the last couple of years that I've noticed that the growth on the branches, the sub-branches that come off the main branches, instead of coming out into a more of a linear, broad, flat shape, are now growing totally around the limb. The sublimbs are. And even though right now I'm looking up, it looks like small Christmas trees growing out of the main tree. And again, the fractal patterns, I'll call it, of the limb shapes are becoming a little squirrely looking. So I don't know if it's my own paranoia or what, climate change, maybe Fukushima. I don't know if anybody has seen this. I've pointed it out to some associates of mine, and they took a look at it, and they agreed that it's a whole different growth from what I remember. Have you noticed any difference up there in Humboldt? And, of course, I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Yeah. Well, one thing you have to remember about redwoods is they have, as they get older and older, and this is true for other trees, too, but not trees don't often get as old as redwoods. And I'm sure Michael's not talking about a 1,000-year-old redwood tree, but as trees get older, they explore different growth patterns to absorb more sunlight, conserve more water, whatever it might be. So my best guess as to what Michael's observing is this redwood sort of maturing, thinning out reiterated branches, which maybe happens after, depending, 100 years, or if a tree's injured and another tree hits it, it's going to respond by sending out shoots in that direction. So the complexity of a tree increases with age. So Michael may be seeing that. And, of course, scientists at Humboldt State and other areas are beginning to see, read into the redwood changing with climate change. More the fog is decreasing. They're putting on more biomass, at least recently. So these are things that are being watched with the redwoods. So that's my best answer for Michael.
Okay, Jim and Grants Pass. Now I got your button pushed. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Kaufman.
Yeah, it's a little subject. I remember talking with the timber cruiser that worked with my mother in office about 50 years ago. Huge difference in rapid change of growth of conifers in, let's say, California, Alaska, when there was massive disruption of forests with the gold rush and then the building of the railroad. There are huge amounts of timber, the residue and everything sent hundreds of miles, you know, downstreams and everything. And I've always been curious, is there a basic DNA test for a conifer?
Yeah, scientists definitely have the ability to look at DNA. They look at certain markers, so they're not looking across the genome, but they're able to look at certain markers and repeat that and see those patterns. So, yeah, this is a new science. Scientists are beginning to look at it. I know David O'Line at Southern Oregon is doing a neat job with firs, looking at some of the genetics of firs, and I think even foxtail pines as well. So, yeah, this is a new science that we're beginning to use to understand relationships between species or subspecies. So, yeah, good stuff.
All right. John and Vanita, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Kaufman. John, you there?
Beat my old drum again. I've been on a show about trees and forests many times, and I always try to get folks to focus on the language because corporations and governments love to twist language to get their way, and old growth is a term that just drives me up the wall because it can mean anything you want. And what I tell people is try to squeeze out of them, is this primeval forest, is it truly virgin forest? Because if that's what it is, then we have a definition and we'll know what we're protecting here, you know, because there's not much of it left. I always tell people, take a plane ride if you don't believe me. And then I have a quick question for the guest. The Columbus Day storm, I remember when I was a kid, I was always fascinated with big trees. I remember all these weird stories that had come up from the big wind just smashed everything. And up in Washington, they had a tree that fell down, and they had to measure in segments because it obviously broke in pieces. But this fir, this is an Oregon fir, a Doug fir, was supposed to have been 425 feet tall. And I was wondering if you heard anything about that. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
Yeah, I'm not super up on the big tree stuff. I do appreciate big trees, and I have heard about these legends of 400-foot-tall Douglas firs and redwoods. And I do agree also about the term old growth. I think I like the term because it implies that you're going to see a big tree, but really what we mean is a varied age forest. So we're talking about a forest that has saplings, 200-year-old trees, and maybe 800-year-old trees. So we've got the whole spectrum of disturbance, and the dynamic forest is represented in that. So, yeah, thanks for the call.
And let's take another one from Nancy in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Michael Kaufman's our guest.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, I have a very quick question. Why, as I understand it, the Douglas fir isn't a true fir, why is it always grouped with the firs? What is it that makes it, why is it called a fir?
All yeah, right. Good question.
Thanks for that.
I think the easiest way to look at it is the development of the cone. The Douglas fir cone has these exerted bracts that...
That's B-R-A-C-T, I notice.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You see that in the bristlecone fir that we were talking about. But the Douglas fir is not a true fir because the cones don't sit upright on the tops of the trees. And it also has a little bit to do with the needle attachment to the branch as well. And there's a few other characteristics. But, yeah, this is the problem with common names, is it often portrays a relationship that isn't there.
We have an email here from Carl and Selma. He says, can you speak about the Brewer spruce?
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, the Brewer's spruce. It's this, it's our special endemic tree here in the Klamath Mountains. 60 million years ago, you could find them in what's now Nevada and out into eastern Oregon and maybe even Idaho. But with climate change, they've retracted into the Klamath Mountains, and now you can find them basically from Castle Crags and then in a sort of northwest trajectory all the way up into the Calamiopsis Wilderness near Selma and Cave Junction. So beautiful species. It had a relative in the southern Colorado region that went extinct, but we still have, because of our special climate here, we've been able to have this tree hang out for a long time. So if I could just mention, is it all right to jump in here and mention about the weekend in Ashland?
You have a weekend in Ashland. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so Friday night I'll be giving a talk at the Geos Institute. I think it's 84 4th Street in Ashland. And it's going to be a photographic journey along the Pacific slope. So we're going to start in Baja, California, at the southern tip of the California Floristic Province in the Sierra San Pedro Martir National Park. And I'm going to show you the conifer landscape north all the way into Washington and focusing on some areas in Oregon as well.
That's Friday at the Geo Center?
Friday at the Geos Institute, and that's at 7, starts at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Saturday morning, I'm going to team up with the Pacific Crest Trail Association and my buddy Ian Nelson, and we're going to lead a hike up on the Pacific Crest Trail from Green Springs Summit to Hobart Bluff, and we're going to talk about the ecology of the trees and a little bit of the tale of the Pacific Crest Trail. But that we are asking that you sign up for that, and you have to call the Northwest Nature Shop, who's been a... I actually did a workshop this summer with the Siskiyou Field Institute, and Kathy Utoff joined me on that, and we began to talk about me coming to town this fall. So this is the manifestation of that, and we'll explore some conifers in Ashland in the Rogue Valley.
All right, we'll see if we can put some links to that on our Facebook page as we go through the day. So good to have you back here, Michael Kaufman, to talk about conifers of the Pacific Slope.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I appreciate your time.
You bet. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the Oregon Bike Travel Program. Since it is Wednesday, we will have our Vents Day segment. We'll talk about results of the election and how you feel about spying on our allies. And then we'll talk at 9 o'clock about veterans and their Social Security benefits and what they have coming to them, what's available that they might not know about. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.